Live from Southern California, this is the Jim Rome Show.
It is official. We're bringing them back. And I do have an announcement of when and where the first one is going to be, and I'll get to that momentarily. But first, a little background for those of you who are not familiar with the history of the event. And not to toot our own horn, clones, but the truth is, back in the day, they were events. Back in the day, they were events because there was really nothing like it in the industry at the time. In fact, I would argue that for what I do and where I live, there really has not been anything like it since then either. I mean, sure, hosts take their shows on the road. And yes, we are starting to see podcasts and the like pop up in theaters and venues. But that's not what this was. That's not what I'm talking about. I'm talking about a stage show in arenas in front of upwards of 18,000 people. And in the case of Houston, even more than that. At Enron, we had more than that. You know, back in the day where, and these were not broadcast. This was not on air. But back in the day, I'd hit the stage, talk some junk, interview some athletes and coaches, and then have an event where the clones could come together, mobilize, and celebrate the show and the relationships that were made around that show. And we would all just let it rip. And it would take place over the course of a number of hours. And it was absolutely amazing. I mean, even as I look back at it today, and I look at some of the pictures from back in the day, I'm shocked in the way it all came together, the way it did. And then back then, generally, we would do 3 or 4 a year. And they would take place all over the country. I took the Jungle World Tour all around California. We went to Wisconsin. We went to Texas. We went to Arizona. We went to Ohio. We went to New York. We went to Colorado. We went to Michigan. We went to Nebraska. We went to Florida. I mean, pretty much everywhere. New Mexico. And it was amazing. And while I have done station visits and appearances, we have not had an actual tour stop since October of 2004 in Cleveland, if I remember correctly. And for the record, for all the heat that Cleveland gets nationally, I count the Cleveland appearances not only as among the best ever in tour stop history, but among the best days of my entire life professionally. Cleveland. Honestly, that good. And that was one of the biggest reasons why we walked it off in Cleveland back in the day. So we put it aside. And I remember thinking at that time, it's just time to kind of put this thing over there for a little while. And I'm sure we'll bring it back. But we never did. And I've thought about it a lot over the years. If I'm going to bring this back, how am I going to bring this back? And we kept thinking. And then we got to work. And now it's official. Now, a couple of more notes before the announcement. It's been a long, long time since we've done these things. If you went to them back in the day, you remember what they were like. Obviously, it's been a long time. The world has changed dramatically in the last decade and a half, so we have to change with it. That goes without saying. This is not going to be a tour in huge outdoor stadiums or gigantic indoor arenas. I got to step my game up, right? I have to change
up.
This time around, we're going to hit some upscale theaters and the like. In other words, I'm going to class this thing up. And yes, this time we are selling tickets. Last time it was free. This time it's not. But there will be lots of different value propositions. So you decide if you want to be a part of it. You decide if you want to come. And if you do want to come, you decide how big of a swing that you want to take. We do have a number of different ticket options, including a few VIP packages. Of course, if you want a VIP package, you're going to be asked to pay for that. But some of those packages include a private meet and greet,
a private party
after the show. You know, if that's the type of thing you're into, if that's the type of thing that you're interested in, we do offer that. If you have any other questions, you can hit me up right now on the phones, 1-800-636-8686. I'm here to answer your questions. I am pumped to get this thing going. The entire crew is pumped to get this thing going. We are ready to bring it back. The reboot, 2.0, whatever you want to call it. The return of the tour stop. It's coming. The first one. The first one is going to be April 11th. April 11th in, wait for it. Help me out, Alvy. It's going to be in, because that's so hard, Alvin. April 11th in Buffalo. The shiny up-and-coming city of Buffalo at Shea's Buffalo Theater. April 11th. We are rebooting the Jungle World Tour, the Jim Rome World Tour in Buffalo. April 11th, Shea's Buffalo Theater. Tickets are now on sale. Here's the thing about the tickets now. They're on sale exclusively for your clones. You clones. They go on sale to the general public, however, next Friday. You clones can start buying tickets right now with a password, which I'm about to give you. They go on sale to the general public a week from today. Here's what you want to do. Go to JimRomeWorldTour.com. 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 Go there right now. If you want to buy a ticket right now, you need the password. The password is jungle. The password is jungle. JimRomeWorldTour.com. Password jungle. The public gets their shot a week from today. You long-time loyal clones, get your shot right now with the password. Get your tickets right now. There are a number of different packages that are available. JimRomeWorldTour.com. Password jungle to get your tickets right now. There are VIP packages that are on sale right now. There are tickets that are on sale right now. Clones, hit it hard. I am so pumped to bring this thing back. I need to see you out there. JimRomeWorldTour.com. Password jungle. Tickets, VIP packages, both on sale right now, but they're limited. These are not gigantic venues like the ones we used to do it in. So you want to jump in there right now. Advanced ticket sales are made possible when you go to JimRomeWorldTour.com. Now, what happens when you go there? Check it out. Hit it up. Let me know. But when you go there, the site is live. What it does is it connects you to Ticketmaster. And there are advanced pre-sale tickets. When you get to Ticketmaster, if you get lost or you have trouble, just type in the word clones, type in the word jungle. I would imagine Jim Rome shows up there somewhere. Do not type in the word scrotum. That's not going to get you anywhere. But we're bringing it back. Buffalo is our first stop. April 11th. And if you're wondering, hey, Rome, what do we get? What do we get for that ticket? We're working on it. The show is in development as we speak. Hey, Buffalo, talk to me. What's Buffalo like in the middle of April? What is Shea's like? Were you at our last Buffalo tour stop? What is your reaction? Buffalo, I picked you. 1-800-636-8686. Man, that feels good. I am pumped. Let's go to the phones. We're starting in Buffalo. Hit me up right now. Phone lines are open. Hawk, pick them up. 1-800-636-8686. Let's go to Buffalo. Crowley. Crowley, my man. What's up? How are you?
Hey, Rome. First of all, thanks for the vine, man. Long time. Second of all, we are completely stoked that you're getting the wheels back on the road and you are showing up in our great city of Buffalo, New York, man. I thought for sure this thing was going to go Wisco. I thought it was going to go, you know, SoCal by you. But, man, I'm going to tell you what. You're going to come to Shea's Buffalo, New York. And this theater, Jim, let me tell you, it was built in 1926. And you're going to be sharing the stage that the Marx Brothers were on, Sinatra was on, Bob Hope. This is the last surviving theater that was designed by Tiffany. In 1970s, around there, when the city of Buffalo was a freaking dumpster fire, they almost tore this place down. But in the last 20 years, a group of people got together, all volunteers, and fixed this place up. Rome, this theater is elegant. It's decadent. It's beautiful. And I cannot wait for you to come pull through Buffalo and do this tour stop, starting off the right way, elegant theater. And I want to also open it up to all the clones, Clone Nation. Come to our city. Come to our great city of Buffalo, and you're going to see that it's not a bunch of mothballed steel plants and mercury levels out off the chart in Lake Erie. You're going to see a little bit of historical relevance that's still present in the city of Buffalo. So, Rome, I am amped up to start the weekend right. I'm taking it up to 11. This tour stop is going to be awesome, and I can't wait to see you, man.
Man, I can't even believe how amazing that phone call was. Crowley, great job. You have an amazing weekend. I will look for you that night. Rack him. Not only could I not have done a better job of setting that up, I didn't. Crowley did a better job of setting up the tour stop than I did because he laid out what it means. He laid out what Shays is like. He laid out to everybody, hey, you know what? Instead of killing us all the time, why don't you come to our city and find out what we're about? It's another great point about the world tour. You don't need to live in Buffalo or in and around Buffalo to experience something like that. Why don't you go to Buffalo and find out for yourself what Buffalo is all about? And it's not by coinkydink that we're starting in Buffalo. This is how much I think about that town. This is how much they've meant to me in the jungle. I could have made an argument for about 15 different places that I felt just as strongly about, but Buffalo wins out. And if Buffalo goes as well as I think it's going to go, we're going to roll this thing back out and we'll start doing it again. I love what he said about Shays. And like I said, I was going to bring it back. And when I decided to bring it back, I knew I had to do it differently. We're classing this thing up a little bit. That is so great what he said about the history of that theater and the others who have hit that stage prior to me getting there. Once again, it is April 11th. It is in Buffalo. Go to JimRomeWorldTour.com. Understand, it is different this time around. The world has changed. It's been more than a decade and a half. We are selling tickets, but there are various value propositions for you. If it's not your bag, if it's not your deal, if you want to listen to me on the radio, that's great. If you want to see something different and you want to see me bring it to you live in your town and you're willing to come out for that, then I'm here for it. It's totally up to you. I just want to let you know that we're doing it. And I can't wait to get back to Buffalo. And I can't wait to get to Shays. All right, quick timeout. Phone lines are open. I want to hit you up. Or I want you to hit me up. Hey, man, obviously, I'm fired up. I can't even speak it as quickly as I think it. And I generally talk pretty fast. Buffalo, it feels good. In fact, everybody feels amazing. The world tour is back. Let me take a moment and talk to you about Root Insurance. Now, what if good drivers did not have to pay for all the bad drivers? So Root developed a mobile app that measures driving behavior. By removing bad drivers from the equation, Root saved good drivers up to 52% in 2019. So gone are the days where your car insurance rate is based on your credit score, your age, your gender, your zip code. With Root, it's car insurance made easy, using an app to base rates primarily on how you drive. In other words, better drivers do deserve better rates. That's why the Root app uses driving behavior as the primary factor to determine car insurance rates. And in 2019, Root was the fastest growing direct insurance company in the United States. All you have to do is download the Root Insurance app, drive normally for a few weeks during the Root test drive, and then see how much money you save. Man, give it a try. Head on over to the App Store, download the Root Insurance app, and sign up in less than 1 minute and start your test drive right now. That's R-O-O-T, Root. Again, download the Root app right now or visit joinroot.com and learn more and see how much money you can save. Not available in all states. Disclaimers may apply. Visit joinroot.com for details. He is Ross Tucker. Ross, what's going on?
Jim, I'm fantastic, man. How about yourself?
So good, Ross. Great to visit with you. Thanks for making time. A lot to cover, so let me just jump right into it. a lot to cover, and we could talk about the CBA, and it's not the most exciting topic in the world, but Ross, what was your reaction when you heard the notion that they were looking to expand the playoffs? Is more better in this case?
Well, so from a player's perspective, I absolutely love it because you're only asking four teams to play one more game. So 12.5% of the teams play one more game, and that gives us two standalone games, wild card weekend, which, as you know, that is a ton of money being injected into the system, into the cap for all players. So from a player's perspective, love it. As a broadcaster, I mean, I'm going to watch the heck out of those games. I love it, adding two more games. I do think that there are some fair concerns to be had. I know there are people that are concerned about watering down the playoffs. That's not really my deal, Jim. I'm okay with that. I mean, when they first went to 12 playoff teams in 1990, there were 28 teams in the NFL. This is before Jacksonville and Carolina. So 42.9% of the teams made the playoffs. Now it'll be 14 out of 32. That's 43.8%. So it's not even a full percent more. So those aren't the things that bother me. If I had a concern, is that we are totally diminishing the value of the number two seed. I mean, what's cool now, right, is that you really want to be the number one seed for home field advantage and the bye. But then you really want to be the number two seed, like the Chiefs were after Fitzmagic beat the Patriots, so that you get a bye. Now it'll be number one seed or bust. Some people say they like that. I just think if you have a year like this year where the Ravens were clearly going to be the number one seed, there's not that much of a difference between 2, 3, and 4, which would mean there's not much of a difference between being the 13-3 Packers or the 9-7 Eagles that barely get in.
Well said. Ross Tucker, my guest. You're right. It devalues the 2 seed, but man, it's got to make that 7 seed feel pretty damn good. Ross Tucker joining us. All right, Ross, let me ask you about the CBA. Now, J.J. Watt immediately came out yesterday and tweeted that he was, quote, a hard no on the collective bargaining agreement. He did so before leaders from the NFLPA even got on the phone today to talk about that. What was your reaction when you saw that from him?
Extremely disappointed in him. I would tell him that to his face. I would love to talk with him about it in any sort of public forum. I mean, you're talking about a guy, Jim, first of all, he was teammates with Eric Winston, who's the president of the NFLPA. And JJ, he's a tremendous player. I know everybody loves him, and he's great on social media and Saturday Night Live, but he's not a player rep. He's not on the executive committee. He hasn't put in over 300 hours over the last 10 months like these players have. So to just say it's a hard no without even, like, calling Eric Winston and talking to him about it, I just can't believe that he would do that in a public forum like that. And then, by the way, have no reasoning as to why he's a hard no. I would love to know why he's a hard no on a CBA, Jim, that is better on every single line item across the term sheet that JJ just played 9 years on. And maybe even more to the point, that guy's made over $85 million. He is one of 5 or 10 guys in the whole NFL, 15 maybe, that have done that. This CBA is for 2,000 men who are doing whatever they can to try to get a great head start financially for their families and some financial security, getting the league minimum for 3 years before they blow out their knee or 5 years before they lose their job to a guy that's younger. This is really, really serious. And the NFLPA represents those 2,000 guys. So for a guy that's made over $85 million, and by the way, he deserves a voice. And he has absolutely a right to voice his opinion. But for a guy that's not in the negotiations at all, to not even say what he doesn't like about it and not understand that he is not even really representative of the group we're talking about here, It's extremely disappointing. I've spoken with a number of players and former players this morning that are irate with him right now.
Ross Tucker is my guest. Ross, if you had to guess, what do you think it is that he does not like about that agreement?
A couple things. Number one, he probably doesn't like the 17th game. I think most guys are just generally opposed to the 17th game, which is a shame, Jim, because I think they probably don't understand the economics of it. Like, I'd love to sit down with them. You know, everybody's like, oh, the owners are going to get what they want. Jim, you know this. The 17th game is primarily about TV revenue. The players get 55% of the TV revenue. The players benefit more from the 17th game than the owners do. It's so frustrating how many poorly informed people, including some players, speak out on social media about this stuff. Like, if you went on Christmas Day and said to the guys in the locker room, all right, dudes, just heard from the owner. We can play one more game, and you all get 150 grand. Because, by the way, that's at least what the 17th game is per player being injected into the salary cap. Every single guy, Jim, would say, heck yeah, I'm in. I mean, maybe one or two super-duper rich guys like Richard Sherman or J.J. Watt would say no, but almost unilaterally, those guys would say, you know what, we already did training camp, we already did the whole season, 150 grand for one more game at this point? Heck yeah, we'll do it. And that's what I think is a real shame, is people don't understand that. And I see all this stuff, Jim, about players are they need to sit out. You're not going to sit out. No guy is going to sit out. That's the whole point. They don't really have leverage. Maybe J.J. Watt and Richard Sherman would sit out. None of the other guys are going to. Their wife is going to say to them, you're getting $72,000 a week, and you're going to sit here? You have to absolutely go out there, and you need to do whatever it takes to play. Guys are not going to sit out, so they don't really have leverage.
Hey, Ross, this point about the 17th game, and you're talking about if you went to every guy and said, we'll give you 150 grand, do you want to play? And they'd say yes. The guys that are saying no are pushing back on that $250,000 cap, right? And the ones who are doing that, of course, are the ones who make enough money that if you were to prorate that, they would make more than 250 grand for that game. How many guys are actually in that position, and do you even care? I mean, do you understand why they would feel that way, or should they do what's better for the sport and say yes to that?
So, as usual, Jim, you're on top of it. I didn't get there yet, but that is exactly right. If I had to guess, J.J. Watt doesn't like the idea of the 17th game and really doesn't like that he won't make his same rate. And I get that. I think that's the worst term in the whole term sheet. That makes no sense to me why that would be capped. It absolutely should be the situation where they get what they've gotten the whole year. I don't know why it's capped. I'd be frustrated too. But the reality is, they're not going to go to 17 games until 2021 at the earliest, maybe later than that. And it only affects the guys that are currently under contract through 2021, 2022, 2023 that make more than 250 grand. I'd love for somebody to go through, because it's really not that many guys. It's really not that many guys that feel that way or that would be affected by it.
Ross Tucker, my guest. All right, Ross, one quick thought, and I do appreciate your thoughts on that. Normally, I would say CBA is not something people want to hear about, but I'm so glad you and I had that conversation. If you were Joe Burrow, would you be trying to use whatever leverage you have to try to avoid the Bengals?
It's a great question. I know what I wouldn't be doing. I wouldn't be doing what he's doing right now. He's kind of beating around the bush, Jim. You know, he's kind of trying to have it both ways. If he really doesn't want to play for the Bengals, then I'm okay with that. I'm okay with a player. No, I wouldn't love it, but as a former player, I'm okay with guys doing whatever they think is best for their career. And if he really doesn't want to be a Bengal because he doesn't like the ownership or the franchise, I'm okay with that. I just wish he would say it. You know, he's being asked if it's a long process. They got their process. I've got mine. And maybe you could argue, Jim, that he doesn't know yet. Maybe he wants to sit down and talk to them and find out whether or not he's comfortable being a Bengal. And if that's the case, that's fair. Personally, I love the city of Cincinnati. And, you know, I see where Carson Palmer says they're not committed to winning a Super Bowl or whatever. I mean, in the last 8 years, they had a period where they went to the playoffs 5 straight years with Andy Dalton, who's perennially average, as their quarterback. 5 straight years. That's hard to do. So if I'm Joe Burrow, I'd like to think that I'm confident enough in my abilities to think if they were able to put a team around Andy Dalton that could go to the playoffs 5 straight years, why can't I get them to championship games, Super Bowls, and be the hero around here?
He played 7 years in the NFL. He is an NFL analyst. He is the host of the Ross Tucker Football Podcast. He is the co-host of Home and Home. You can follow him at Ross Tucker NFL. Hey, Ross, my man, I appreciate it so much. You had another long week. You could have already gone to the weekend. You're still doing work. I respect it. I appreciate it. And that's a great job by you, as always, Ross. Thanks so much.
Anytime, you know that, man. I'm actually in the car with my family on the way to the ski trip. But when Jim Rome calls, I answer.
My man. All right, starting with some baseball. Another day, another guy weighing in on Rob Manfred and the Houston Astros. This time, it was none other than David Ortiz. Now, if you know Big Poppy, you know he was digging in, getting ready to swing out his ass, digging in and taking some really big cuts. He's Big Poppy. He's David Ortiz. Big cuts, starting with the commissioner. Like, if Mike Trout is jumping in, if Justin Turner is saying things like, quote, at this point, the only thing devaluing that trophy is that it says commissioner on it. If John Lester is calling the commissioner, quote, someone that has never played our game. If LeBron James is jumping into the fight and tweeting, listen here, baseball commissioner, then you know David Ortiz is going to have something good. Poppy, let it rip. Tell us what you really think about the commissioner and do not hold back. I mean, given how this guy has handled the entire situation and what he has said recently, he literally has all of this coming to him, Poppy. So do what you do, big man. Lay this sucker out. And you know, Big Poppy, he just spent about 30 minutes at the bat rack selecting his weapon. Now it's time to swing it. What do you got, big dog? Let the old man have it.
I feel bad for him because, you know, people asking questions like he was the one who started this up. Like, I see players trying to tell him what he need to do. Hey, he don't tell you how to hit or how to pitch. So let him do his job, you know. He gonna do what is best for the game.
Wait, what? Are you talking about the commissioner? Was that Big Poppy talking about Rob Manfred? That's like the biggest record scratch ever. David Ortiz rushing in to defend the commissioner when every other player is looking to destroy the commissioner. That is weird. Really weird. And not the good kind of weird. And it only got even more weird as Big Poppy continued to speak.
He's good at making decisions, but people need to chillax. People need to let him do his job. Players need to let him do what he think is better for the game and for everything else. You know what I'm saying? And stop putting him on the spot and telling him what to do.
All right, clones, help me out on this. I need your help on this because recently I had a pretty nasty ear infection. And truth be told, nobody gives a damn, but if you're listening to me right now, I think it's coming back somehow, some way. And by the way, I had like 10 days of meds, and you can't kill whatever it is that's floating around right now. Anyway, I did have a pretty nasty ear infection, so help me with this, because I really couldn't hear anything at all for the better part of 2 weeks. So help me. Did David Ortiz just tell everybody to, quote, chillax?
To chillax.
In the year 2020, somebody just used the word chillax.
your locks.
And did he use it in reference to the commissioner of baseball? What? As if? And not! Didn't want any of that. Hey, dudes, back off the commissioner. He's the bomb. The commissioner's balling. He's doing some sick things. It's about time you got on board the fresh train with the commissioner. And y'all just chillax.
Chillax.
I mean, I don't know what's more ridiculous. Somebody using the word chillax in 2020? Or somebody defending the commissioner in 2020? Or somebody defending the commissioner in 2020 by telling everybody to chillax?
Chillax.
That is one of the most disappointing takes ever, big fella. And how about this notion that people shouldn't be, quote, putting him on the spot and telling him what to do? Something else that David Ortiz actually said. My man, with respect, when you are the commissioner, you're always on the spot. It's your job. It's what you signed up for. It's what they're paying you a lot of money to do. And you shouldn't need people telling you what to do. You should already know what to do. And the only reason people are telling him what to do is because he doesn't know what the hell he's doing. He's running around, having press conferences, doing interviews, and making the entire thing worse. Manfred mishandled the entire situation from the jump and then made it even worse by misreading the entire mood of the sport and then reducing the World Series trophy to, quote, a piece of metal.
Piece of metal.
Poppy, people are telling him what to do because he's made a bad situation even worse and everybody is pissed. Except Poppy, he wasn't done. In fact, unfortunately, he was only getting started.
The commissioner, Manfred, has been legit since day one. You know what I'm saying? And I don't think it's fair for everyone pitching him, question, and blame him on things.
I mean, my man's got to be trolling us so hard. It's a joke, right? The commissioner has been legit since day one? It's not fair to question him and blame him? Are you kidding me with that? The commissioner could not have butchered this any worse than he did. Of course he should be questioned. Of course he should be blamed. No, he wasn't the one cheating, but he was the one in charge of investigating the cheating and communicating what he found to everybody when he investigated the cheating and he jacked it all up. The hell are you talking about, Poppy? Are we talking about the same guy? Are we talking about the same sport? Are we talking about the same cheating scandal? What a weird, weird take from David Ortiz. And yes, I do know the commissioner had Ortiz's back when he retired and said the 2003 PED survey results should not be considered when it comes to Hall of Fame voting. I'm guessing maybe Ortiz really appreciated that and he wants to have the commissioner's back right now. Or maybe it's a matter of Ortiz just trying to soften up or butter up the commissioner before the league releases its investigation into the Red Sox. Or it could just be a really, really weird take from David Ortiz because he had a number of those, including this one, on Mike Fears.
I'm mad at this guy, the pitcher that came out talking about it, and let me tell you why. Oh, after you make your money, after you get your ring, you decide to talk about it? Why don't you talk about it during the season when it was going on? Why you didn't say, I don't want to be no part of? Oh, now. So you look like a snitch. You know what I mean? Why you got to talk about it after? That's my problem, you know. Why nobody say anything while it was going on?
All right, so his two big takes. The commissioner is doing a great job, and everybody should get off his back, and Fears is a snitch. Let me read you part of that back. Quote, after you make your money, after you get your ring, you decide to talk about it. Why don't you talk about it during the season when it was going on? Why didn't you say, I don't want to be no part of it? So you look like a snitch. End quote. It's a hell of a take now. I mean, of all the villains in this story, Fears is not one of them. You might not like this guy personally, but he's not the bad guy here. And moreover, he's not a snitch. You're confusing snitch with whistleblower. They're not one and the same. Whistleblowers are actually a good thing. They shed light on serious problems. The whistleblower is the one who's got the balls to step forward. They're the ones who draw attention to what happened. If Fears didn't say anything at all, there would not have been this investigation into the Astros, and we would not have learned what happened. And they'd still be cheating, and there would still be an unlevel playing field. Would that be better? Would that be a good thing? I know it would be a good thing for the Astros, but would that be a good thing for every other team and for the sport in general? Let me tell you something. And a lot of you don't believe this, but it's true. The only people who call other people snitches are the people who have something to hide. If Ortiz's beef is with the timing of it and the fact that Fears didn't say anything while he was with the team and only said it afterwards, then his beef is also with the entire Astros team who never said anything at all. And all the other former Astros who went to other teams and never said anything at all. And it does raise a very obvious question, right? If Ortiz is such a huge proponent of guys speaking out when a problem is happening, where was Ortiz and why was he not speaking out during the PED era? Because I don't remember hearing anything from him at that point during that when he was getting paid. What about that? I hate to do this, but I'm about to bring in Jose Canseco, of all people, as the voice of reason on this. Canseco said, quote, Mike Fears, the truth is never wrong, no matter when you say it. It's never too late for the truth. Big Poppy, I am a fan since the first time I met you in Minnesota, but get off this, kid. You made it through the PED era, end quote. Wow. I mean, I'm not sure that I thought that I was going to say this, but Jose Canseco was right. Fears isn't a snitch. He's a whistleblower who told the truth and blew the lid off a massive cheating scandal. There are a lot of really bad guys in this, but Fears isn't one of them. So just chillax on him. In fact, Big Dog, chillax on everything. Chillax. You're not making any sense at all. So no, we're not turning the page on this yet. Not as long as guys are rushing in with their hot takes. And especially if that hot take includes telling everybody that the commissioner is doing an amazing job and that the rest of us all need to, quote, chillax. Are you craving some protein after a good workout? Do not make a shake or eat a bar. Grab a bag of beef jerky from Old Trapper. Old Trapper beef jerky is tasty and tender. It's made with real strips of steak and quality spices that are smoked over a real wood fire, and it goes wherever you go. To the game, to the gym, to the beach. Look for Old Trapper in the Clearview bag. You can see the quality you're buying. Look for it in major retail stores near you. If you don't see it, ask for it by name, because no other jerky compares. Old Trapper, what's your beef? Luca Garza is my guest. Luca, good to have you. How are you?
I'm great. How are you?
Good. Really good. All right, so you had that big game last night against a very good Ohio State team. Let me start right there. Going into the game, you knew the team was a little bit banged up and the rotation might be a little bit shorter. So what was your mindset as a team and an individual going into last night's matchup?
Well, for us, you know, we've been here before. You know, we've had CJ out before and we've been banged up all year kind of. And so our team was kind of ready for this moment. And, you know, we have a real next man up mentality on our team. So, you know, I was just really proud of the guys off the bench who really stepped up and were able to score the ball and help us out, especially against such a great defense like Ohio State. And we really need that to take pressure off guys like, you know, me and Joe Wieskamp when teams are game planning for us. So, you know, those guys coming off the bench was huge for us and led to the win.
Iowa center Luca Garza joining us. Now, you know, the team is in third place in the Big Ten, a really tough conference, but you were picked to finish eighth. What maybe did you know about this team before the season that maybe people outside the program did not know about the team?
Well, I could feel it, you know, as soon as spring workout started last year, just the way the ball was moving on offense. You know, we were playing pickup and working out, and you could just really tell this team was really connected offensively first. And then I think we started to work on our defense, and we've just made huge strides in that area, and I think we've become, you know, a generally connected team on both ends. And, you know, I kind of saw that coming, you know, going into this year, and I think that's what it's been showing all year.
So we're late in February right now, and the team is playing really, really well. If this team is playing this way into March, what's the upside? Are you thinking about this team possibly making a deep run in the tournament? Does it have that kind of potential?
Yeah, the sky is the limit. You know, when our team plays this well, we have many guys, you know, stepping up off the bench and everybody scoring. And, you know, when we're you know, playing defense like we did last night. You know, we're a team that we know we can score on anybody in the country, and I think we've proved that. But, you know, the biggest thing for us is being able to defend and string together stops, you know, to get wins. So I think, you know, this team, if we're locked in on the defensive end, I think we have, you know, a lot of potential to do some great things.
We're talking Iowa basketball. Luka Garza is my guest. Last night, as I mentioned, Luka was your 12th straight Big Ten game with 20 points or more. You dropped 44 on Michigan in their building, which was a record for a visitor. You had 38 at Assembly Hall last week, which nearly broke the record for a visitor. Every team that you face now knows that you're coming and they're trying to stop you, yet you keep putting numbers up. How do you explain that?
I think, you know, credit to my teammates. I think my teammates, you know, really find me in my spots. And, you know, we have to push the ball in transition really hard so they can't, you know, double team as easy. And, you know, I think my team has been doing a great job of just finding me, you know, when I'm open and, you know, when the double team can't get there. And I think, you know, for me, I think playing hard is the most important part of my game. You know, I being able to play hard, you know, gets me a lot of baskets and is the reason I can be so consistent.
Listen, I know if I ask you about you again, you're going to say something about the team again, but the fact of the matter is you're playing so well that you're getting a lot of attention for National Player of the Year awards. What's it like when you hear that, and what would it mean to you to be named the National Player of the Year?
I mean, it would mean the world to me. It's something you could, you know, you dream of as a kid, and it's something that I never could have thought, you know, my name would ever be in that discussion. And, you know, I've been doubted my whole life, and I've just worked through it and pushed through everything by working hard. And I think, you know, working hard can make your dreams come true. So, you know, that would be an honor, and, you know, just it would be the best feeling ever.
Luka Garza, my guest, I want to take a few moments before I let you go and talk about your process and your journey. If we were to go back, what you're doing now is not an accident, nor is it luck. It is a result of that process. As an example, after your sophomore year in high school, you did not have any major college offers. How would you describe your game at that point, and what were your thoughts about your future in basketball at that point?
You know, a lot of people, you know, had their doubts because I wasn't very gifted athletically, and I was big, but I couldn't really move. And so, you know, that's something that's followed me my whole career, but especially in high school. You know, high majors were hesitant to offer me because they didn't think, you know, my game would translate to the high major level. And, you know, Coach McCaffrey took a chance on me, and he was my only, you know, high major offer up until, you know, my junior year, after my junior year going into the, you know, my last AAU, run. And, you know, that's when I started to play really well, and I collected a lot of high major offers, and I was, you know, widely known as a high major guy. But, you know, I rewarded the loyalty of Coach in the end because he saw something in me that a lot of different coaches, you know, passed on. And, you know, that's why I came here, and that's why I wanted to play for Coach.
Luka Garza, my guest. One more thing, too. You and your father, Frank, right around that time, started to do really serious workouts over the summer, like conditioning, agility, cardio work, training on the basketball court. What were those workouts like, and then how much did they change you physically and mentally?
You know, it changed my life. You know, my dad is, you know, the person who taught me the game, and he's, you know, we've been working out since I was, you know, 3 years old, you know, and, you know, once I got to high school and, you know, I realized I could really do something with this game, you know, my dad took it to another level, and, you know, I'm just so blessed to have the family that I do that, you know, my dad could put me around him and his college coach and my grandfather who coached in college and my uncle who was a professional basketball player and just, you know, so many people that can help me and guide me and help, you know, add things to my game. So every summer, you know, I go into the off season with a mindset that I want to improve. And I think I've done that every off season of my life. And, you know, I think those workouts in the summer is just, you know, kind of where I changed myself into, you know, a guy who could maybe go, you know, low D1 to a guy who could be a high major basketball player.
Hey, Luka, don't forget about moms. Your mother played pro ball as well. So, like,
oh, yeah,
everybody in the family.
The list goes on and on. My aunt, you know, my grandfather was a professional soccer player. My grandma was a handball player. You know, it's just my family. We can talk for days about that.
See, not only that, it's in the family, but again, it's the grind, man. It's the work ethic. Like last summer, you went to Bosnia where your mother was born, but you didn't relax. You were playing. You were working out three times a day. The workouts involved bricks, punching bags, and more. See, it seems to me most people would hate that. They would shrink away from that. They wouldn't want to do it. You seem to love that grind. Or did you force yourself to love that grind as a strategy?
No, it's interesting. I think a lot of people, you know, dread that part of basketball. And, for me, honestly, it's my favorite part. You know, it's better than the games for me. You know, being able to, you know, work on your craft and grind and work out every day. That's just, you know, that's something I love. That's something I embrace. And, you know, when I don't do that, you know, I feel bad. You know, that's my favorite part of the game. And so, you know, every summer I go into it with a mindset. And like you said, I was in Bosnia working out with my cousin, my uncle, my dad, and we were working out all the time. And that's just, you know, the way our family works. And I was taught that at an early age. And I'm just, like I said before, that I'm just really blessed to have the family that I have.
Listen, last thought, not to be redundant, but there's the preparation and the grind, and then there's the battle, the heat of the moment battle. Against Texas Tech, you took a shot to the face that left you covered in blood. Against Iowa State, you had a tooth displaced. Again, not everybody wants that, but in terms of physicality, you said, I've always been up for the wars and the pain. That's just what I love about basketball. Why is the war and the pain the best part about basketball?
I don't know. I think, you know, ever since I was a kid, I loved, you know, playing in the plane. I love watching, you know, the big men battles of the, you know, the NBA in the past and the history of the game. I just, you know, I just love that stuff. And, you know, I would do anything for my team. So, you know, I'll push through anything. I will, you know, fight and get rebounds. I'll do, you know, whatever it takes to win. And I think, you know, I've always really embraced, you know, the battle and the pain. I think that's one of the reasons I signed up to play in the Big Ten, which is, you know, pretty much in one of the most physical leagues, you know, there is.
For sure. He is a National Player of the Year candidate. Iowa is number 20 in both polls. They've got a big game coming up on Tuesday at Michigan State. Iowa center, Luca Garza. Luca, great to have you on the show. Really appreciate the conversation. Well done by you.
Thank you. I appreciate you.
Right as I went over the bar, the pole recoiled and got me in the two spot.
What's cracking? Welcome to the jungle. My name is Jim Rome. A tremendous Monday to you. Hope you had a good weekend. Nice to have you here. Lots of show to get to. Let's not waste time. NBA All-Star Game was yesterday. So if I'm going to start the program by talking about the national anthem, that's never a good thing. I'm not going to call it weird. I'm just going to say that it was a Shaka Khan version of the anthem. The league made some changes, they took some chances, and it paid off. Can't say how many times I've rolled in here the day after and said, man, that sucked. That was the worst. Not this time. That was a damn good All-Star game. He is Mark Stein. What is their argument for still using a BlackBerry?
I'm not giving up my keyboard. I don't care what scorn is coming my way. Throw this iPhone in the trash.
Jim, I still have my BlackBerry Curve. It's been 10 years.
77.
Happens to us all.
70 freaking 7. The guy went out there and he Ray Borked it. Tiger's back, baby. Back to having a bad back. Back to having even worse rounds. Back to Raymond Borking it. Marcus Howard is my guest.
We wear white jerseys for home games, you know, primarily. And he would always tell the fresh, hope you brought a pair of, like, dark socks because freshmen are going to pee down their leg with nervousness.
In a perfect world, it would have happened.
In other words, look, I'd have loved to have done it. So let's just move on. Yeah, I don't think anybody's moving on, Commissioner. Leonard Hamilton is back.
Hello, Jim. How are you doing on the West Coast?
Where are you?
In a shower of sparks on his
Hamlin is my guest.
Crashing happened all the time at Daytona 500. Definitely didn't know the severity of it till afterwards. Still thinking about Ryan and his whole family. That's our main concern.
Jeff Ward is my guest.
So when you get down 3-1, you often wonder if the guys did not squeeze their sticks hard this time.
What's your beef?
Don't bring it up if it's not worthy.
Anyway, that's my beef, Jim. This is Bob in L.A.
Well, Kathy Lee can go bite my nose. Excuse me.
Kathy Lee can go bite my nuts?
Let that boar ride.
Yo. That guy lit 30 mil on fire. And for what? Caleb Wesson is joining us. What did you make of kale chips?
Oh, it was disgusting. No offense to anybody who eats them, but I don't know how they do it.
Gardner, man, come on.
Hopping in my brand new RV.
Document. My man, document, let us in.
I want some butts!
Where are the pics?
You stink.
Where's the video?
Keep it rolling.
Email.
Dear Rome.
Boom!
Squad! Irate Craig. I might break my own moratorium. All right, so it's Wednesday. You have to think by midweek, pretty much everybody has gotten in their takes on the Astros and the commissioner by now, right?
Piece of metal.
Wrong.
He cheated and he didn't earn it.
Every single guy over there needs a beating.
They cheated. Me going up to the plate knowing what's coming. Pretty fun up there.
No, the commissioner's ever won anything in his life.
You're only really sorry because you got caught.
Cheater! CJ Nikowski.
I feel exactly the same way you do. It's like we're all, you know, all baseball channel when I'm doing radio. We're like, ugh, let's get past it, but you can't.
Mark Pope.
Man, hey, I'm so hyped to be on the show, my friend. My entire forgettable NBA career, I got to listen to your show. So in that sense, I felt like we had to grow up together, man. It's very cool.
We got he struck out Joe Mauer three times.
Three times in high school. I have no idea how he didn't make the show.
Do you know he once went to a wedding and Michael Jordan knew who he was?
I wish you guys nothing but best.
Troy Polamalu.
I started to become impressed, you know, with myself. Wow, I can't believe I play against Tom Brady, you know, Calvin Johnson and Adrian Peterson.
Clones, we're not talking about Yasmin Bleed. I'm not here for it. They don't pay me to do that. Joined right now by Charles Robinson.
I don't even want to know what Yasmin Bleed photos are out there. I need to work the rest of the day, so.
You can't unsee what you've seen, but I'm not going to say that. Hot Dog Delight. Now, you know who's the hot dog king of Maine? Ricked. He's the hot dog king of the world, man.
Come on.
Kelly Bryant.
You know, learning how to walk and eat again, gain weight, but, you know, doing my family and my friends and support helped me to get back on my feet.
Would have been pretty easy at that point for you to say, you know what, football's not in the cards, my career is over, but you didn't. How come?
Man, I'm a fighter, Mr. Rome. You've been a star of my life.
Twitter!
Hey, Catboy! Hey, Catboy! Catboy! I got some fancy feasts for you, Catboy! It's going to be in April 11th in Buffalo! The shiny, up-and-coming city of Buffalo.
That theater should be jam-packed, Jim. I'm so excited. I'm sweating in here.
I am absolutely wasted on jungle crack right now.
I was there in 2001 when they rode you out in that white Bronco.
I'm coming there with my nephew, and I just can't wait.
Can't wait.
Who are you, my grandmother?
Am I speaking to?
You're going to nip me a sweater?
We need to change the whole entire game plan at halftime.
949-385-0447.
Always good to be with you, pal.
You do an unbelievable job for us, so thanks for having me on.
That was a premeditated crop dusting.
She locks.
Don Cherry's video.
When Jim Rome calls, I answer.
Feel like I've been injected with jungle crack. The Jungle World Tour. Buffalo, April 11th. Tickets are for sale right now.
I can't believe how cheap it is.
Just do it, man.
We are completely stoked.
Good night now!
He is Mark Kriegel. Mark, it is good to have you on. How are you?
What's up, buddy? I'm good. Thank you.
In fact, let me put it another way. Before we get to the fight, my man, it's been a long time since I've had you on this show. How is life for you right now, Mark? What's going on?
Everything's good, man. Just busy. I'm in the plane all the time.
That's good, though. Busy's good. You and I know this. All right, so Wilder Fury 2 is tomorrow night, and you're going to work that fight. Mark, you've covered a lot of fights over the course of your career. So for those who have never been, kind of set the scene for me. What is the atmosphere like in Las Vegas in the build-up to a huge fight?
I think you know me well enough. I'm really not shilling here, okay? Because I do work for the broadcast now, but it feels like the old days. Yes, it really feels like the old days. First heavyweight fight I covered here was Bo Holyfield 1, which really sort of alerted me to the possibilities of heavyweight boxing. It's not like any other sport. I'm not even sure it's a sport, really, but it feels like that. In the press room, and I don't know, you know, what the number it'll be. I'm sure they got like smart guys punching it up, but it does feel like a real heavyweight fight.
We're talking to Mark Kriegel. Now, you've got a piece up right now on Deontay Wilder, and the headline is, what happened to the great American heavyweight? Mm-hmm. He's back. His name is Deontay Wilder. That's really high praise, and again, not something you would throw around lightly. Lay it out for me. What have you seen from him that makes you say that?
First of all, you know, when he started years ago, you had a reason to root for him. And you know, he walks into the gym because his kid's born with spina bifida. He's working at IHOP. He's working at Red Lobster. He's driving a beer truck. And he's got an early morning, a 4 a.m. beer run. And he walks into the gym. He doesn't want to be heavyweight champion of the world. He's willing to go in the ring, get knocked around, pay a couple bills. And along the way, he finds out he has this superpower, this right hand, which, as crazy as it may sound, is probably the single most destructive weapon in the history of the sport. There's a theory that the most destructive blows are the shortest, the most compact. Marciano, the punch that Foreman used to take out Moore. His is long. It unfurls like a whip. And it's like everything else about Deontay. It's a complete anomaly. So he walks into the gym to provide for his kid, and he finds out he's really got something. And it goes against the history, certainly for the last quarter century, of American heavyweights. I think one of the reasons people dumped on Deontay is that they didn't trust an American heavyweight. If you're a kid, you know, you're 6'3", you're 6'4", you're 6'5", 240, you run a good 40, you have a vertical jump. You're not in the gym. You're not going to come up in a place where, you know, you're guaranteed it's going to stink, and you know a guy, no one ever cleaned a spit bucket. You're going to go into an athletic dorm in the SEC or the ACC or whatever. You're dunking, you're sacking quarterbacks, you're trying to break backboards. So I think that for a long time now, people didn't trust American heavyweights because they were almost by definition guys who failed at something else. And that was Deontay before he had his first kid, he was trying to walk on at a community college as a power forward. Same old thing. We remember Michael Grant. The only recycled athlete to become a heavyweight champion is, in fact, Deontay Wilder. And I think that the other component to this is that you look back at the history of the division, going back to Dempsey Tunney, almost a damn century. You can't get over, like the wrestlers call it, you can't really pierce the public's consciousness until you have a rival. And it's not that the division just sucked or it lacked talent. My position is it also lacked rivalries. And in the second that Tyson Fury got his ass up in the 12th round of their first fight, he reconfigured the division, perhaps the sport, but he also created a real rivalry with Wilder. And both of these guys need each other. It's peculiar that this kind of sport, and it also holds for MMA, you need what you want to destroy.
Mark Kriegel is joining me. What a great response that was. That was a legendary response.
Now,
Mark,
I loved it.
I miss you, my man. That's why I just let you go and do you. Now, to your point about you need rivals, every sport needs a rivalry. You touched on this in the piece about Wilder, and it came up in the press conference this week as these guys debated which guy was more responsible for the other guy's fame. Mark, how do you answer that question? Did one guy make the other guy, or did they make each other, and do they need each other?
They made each other and they need each other, and I fully expect, as does Fury, and he told us again yesterday that this is the sequel, but it's going to end as a trilogy. And you got to remember, they're already, a lot of the heavy lifting has been done here contractually. They're contracted for a rematch, and the guy who gets to activate it is the loser. So think about, I don't know how it's going to end. I think it's going to end in a knockout. I really don't know who, but either way, it's the loser who's nursing that regret who gets to activate the clause. And if I'm getting this correctly, and I think I am, it's an immediate rematch clause. So Fury says, I have three more fights. Now, I expect him to change his mind, but what he sees is tomorrow night, the rematch with Wilder, and then whoever the hell is after that. He's got three fights left, but they need each other, and Wilder's been kicking around for a long time. He's held that belt, and, you know, I don't think the casual sports fan or even a dedicated sports fan, but a casual boxing fan, really, really gave a damn. The conversation, as far as Wilder is concerned, inevitably focused on what he can't do because, again, he's a recycled American athlete, instead of what he can, which is this great right hand. There was one bit in our conversation, and I really like him, but, you know, last, I guess it's a couple of years, he's talked about, I want a body on my record. And I have some authority to speak on that. I did a book on Mancini. I covered, God help us all, a fatality in the ring last year with Maxim Dadashev. And it pissed me off. I like Deontay, but I had a really difficult time reconciling the guy who says, I want a body, with the guy who cared for his kid the way he did. And I called him on it. And he says, well, that's my alter ego. That's, you know, I got to be like that going into a fight. Oh, come on. That's not right. And then he turned to me and he said, hey, listen, you know what you want to see. I guess he meant like you, and plural, you, the fans.
Boxing fans.
You. Yeah. So you know what you're coming to see. You want to see me take some guy out. And I'm always going to have sympathy and compassion for someone who falls in the ring or anyone who does our sport. But now I'm putting words in his mouth, but this is what he, you know, let's liberate this construct from its hypocrisy. Every knockout is at least a metaphorical death. And you do get some peculiar, I don't know if it's joy, but a jolt from seeing it. You don't want it to go too far, but you want it to go pretty far. And you are watching certainly heavyweight boxing for Armageddon. And I have to say, I'm not comfortable with his answer, but I can't say it's not the truth. And I thought he's actually a pretty stand-up guy for that, too.
Hey, Mark, I mean, this is a fascinating part of the conversation. Like, when he says that, and by the way, he's said it to me before, too, and mm-hmm. I also happen to like Deontay quite a bit. Is he saying, I want to give the fans their money's worth and let them see what they came to see? Because let's face it, we are gladiators and it's a blood sport. Or does he, like, literally want a body?
I think it's the former. I mean, you know, to literally want a body, you're a sick SOB. I'm sorry. So I think that, you know, in the moment he's talking about it, he's sort of in character, and maybe I'm being too easy on him here. But I'd sure like to think it's the former. I mean, what did you think?
I think it's the former, Mark. I think that he, like Jorge Masvidal, I've had this conversation with him. Man, these guys, they're different. They're wired. I always use that phrase. They're wired differently. They know mm-hmm. why we're here. They know that just winning is not enough. They have to win a certain way. I really don't think a guy like that, especially as you mentioned his daughter, I don't think that he wants a body per se. And like you and I, Mark, you and I could talk for literally hours, if not days, about Ray Mancini, who is such an awesome guy. You and I talked when you used to come on my TV show. Mm-hmm. You and I would talk boxing, and we talked about Ray. Like, if you took a couple of minutes or just a little bit of time, like, what kind of an effect did that fight with Do Koo Kim have on Ray? I mean, you can go for weeks on that, but Ray was in that fight, and boxing was very different then. It was a 15-round sport. Like, for those who don't know that story, what happened to Ray?
Ray insisted that he was okay, and he wasn't. he wasn't. And the more sensitive, the more religious, in some respects, the better, more aware person you are, the more difficult it is to deal with. If you're closed and you're a sociopath and you can compartmentalize death, then you're going to be okay. So what hurt Ray, what I think in this terrible way would hurt someone like Deontay is the very sensitive nature of the person himself, the religious nature of the person himself. If you're a sick SOB, then okay, guy died, walk away. But I don't really buy that he wants it. And I do think that being said, that being a championship level heavyweight in particular, I'm sure this is true for MMA too, the lead up to a big fight is itself, you're dealing with monumental egos. To be the heavyweight champion of the world, you have to be really, really high on yourself. But the lead up, build up, getting out there almost naked is a form of insanity, man. It's a form of insanity. And you know, there's nothing, as you said, there was nothing normal about this. Going out there, stepping on a scale in your underwear, talking stuff to the other guy, and there is a part of you that wants to kill him.
Wait, and can I tell you, Mark, you know, I've always thought this, Mark, and I love boxing, and I love mm-hmm. MMA, but why don't we go one step further? You're in your underwear, you're on a scale, and then you're getting in a squared-off circle mm-hmm. in front of people who are there to see you kill the other guy, and if not kill him, then knock him out. I mean, the whole thing is barbaric and incredible, and we all love it. So, again, we can go on and on. What do you think is going to happen tomorrow night in that fight?
The interesting Look what happens at the weigh-in today. The biggest clue to me, check out the weigh-in today. Check out the number that Fury weighs
right
at. If he is 265 or north of it, 270, as he keeps saying, that necessitates a certain kind of strategy. He's not going to dance around, and he can dance. He's as agile and graceful a big man as there has been since Ali. I'm not saying he's Ali, but I am saying in that respect, he is Ali-like, except he's 6'9". But if he's 270, he's not dancing around for 12 rounds. He's being straight with us and saying, I am going for the knockout. And he's retooled with his old team from Kronk. He was at Kronk Gym in Detroit under Emmanuel Stewart for a month in 2010. And he's brought Sugar Hill Stewart, Emmanuel's nephew, and Andy Lee, an Irish middleweight who's also his Tyson's cousin, who trained under Emmanuel for 7 years. He's brought them in this time. And what Kronk is about is, you know, I have good technique, and I am going to use it to take you out. So he wants to be very efficient and very aggressive. He thinks that he can outbox Wilder again, still lose a decision. Also, because Wilder needs just one shot, you can outbox him and find yourself getting cracked too. So he thinks he's going to bully the bully. There's a lot of sense to it. The safest place against a guy like Wilder, who needs to extend, is inside. All of it makes sense, but it still seems antithetical. The boxer is going to go inside and attack. But look at that number on the scale, because that will tell you how I think the early part of the fight goes. I don't think whatever happens, I don't think it lasts beyond six rounds.
Mark Kriegel, my guest. It's going to be an amazing fight, and that conversation helps so much. He is an ESPN boxing insider. He is an Emmy Award-winning broadcaster, and again, the author of Namath, a biography, Pistol, the life of Pete Maravich, and The Good Son, the life of Ray Boom Boom Mancini. Mark, it is so good to have you back. What a great job by you, man. Have a great weekend. Let's do it again soon.
Pleasure, buddy. I miss you.
Good night now!